Welcome to People's Video Audio, a series of talks by author and political analyst Michael Parenti. Today you will hear three talks. The first is The Founding Fathers, the second, The Real Causes of World War II, and the third talk is on Mumia Abu-Jamal, a falsely accused African-American journalist who has been on death row for the past 12 years. Here's Michael Parenti speaking on The Founding Fathers.
As we were taught in school, a group of dedicated leaders of our young nation, called our Founding Fathers, met in Philadelphia in 1787 to build a nation and to write a constitution. The United States of that time has been described as an egalitarian society. It was supposedly free from the extremes of want and wealth that characterized the feudal old world. But in fact, there were landed estates and there were colonial mansions that were really quite impressive and demonstrated a most impressive accumulation of wealth. From the earliest English settlements, men of influence received vast land grants from the British Crown. By 1700, three-fourths of the acreage in New York State belonged to fewer than a dozen persons. By 1760, fewer than 500 men in five colonial cities controlled most of the commerce, the banking, the mining, the manufacturing, and most of the newspapers and journals on the eastern seaboard, and they owned most of the land. This was hardly your egalitarian middle-class society. As of 1787, property qualifications left perhaps more than a third of the white male population disfranchised. Property qualifications for holding office were so steep that most voters could not even qualify as candidates. Thus, a member of the New Jersey legislature had to be worth about £1,000 free of debt even to run for office. There also were no secret ballots. The men who got together in Philadelphia to frame the Constitution were financially successful planters, slaveholders, merchants, creditors, bankers, and manufacturers. Who else can take 4.5 months off to go sit in Philadelphia and write a constitution? Many of them were linked to each other by kinship and marriage and by years of service in Congress or the military or diplomatic service. And they had three things they wanted to do. They wanted to build a stronger central government to deal better with the conditions of trade and industry within the 13 states. They also wanted to build a stronger central government to deal better with other nations. But there was a third reason. It's the one that the historians who don't want to bother with real history never talk about. The framers of the Constitution were very troubled with the increasingly insurgent spirit, rebellious spirit, that among the common population. There were attempts to take over state governments. There was broad agitation. And the wealthy class looked to a national government as a means of protecting their interests, as a means of building a stronger mechanism of national control. Most historians say very little about the actual plight of the common people in that time. Most of the agrarian population, and about 85% of Americans in 1787 lived in the agrarian sector, most of them consisted of small farmers, tenants, or indentured servants. Indentured servants were white people who were in indenture, that is, they were in conditions of servitude. It wasn't quite slavery because it was for a fixed time and they could get out eventually. They could work their way out. These people were burdened by heavy rents, ruinous taxes, and low incomes. To survive, they frequently had to borrow money at very high interest rates. To pay their debts, they mortgaged their future crops. When you mortgage your future crop, you go still deeper into debt. So large numbers of them were caught in that cycle of rural indebtedness, which is today still the common fate of many agrarian peoples in many countries who are in the grip of the moneyed interests. Throughout this period, by the way, newspapers complained of, quote, increasing numbers of young beggars in the streets. Economic prisoners crowded the jails. Many were incarcerated for debts or non-payment of taxes. And among the American people, there grew the feeling that the revolution against the English crown had been fought for no good reason. Disorders of a violent but organized kind occurred in a number of states. In the winter of 1787, the most dramatic disorder was when debtor farmers in western Massachusetts, led by Daniel Shays, took up arms. but their rebellion was crushed by the state militia after several skirmishes that left about 11, that left exactly 11 men dead and scores wounded. When the founding fathers, so-called founding fathers, met in Philadelphia, they were determined that persons of birth and fortune and affluence should control the affairs of the nation and check the, what they call the leveling impulses of the propertyless multitude that composed the, what Madison called a majority faction. James Madison, who played probably the most crucial role in the Constitution, putting the Constitution together, talked about how it was important in his famous Federalist Paper number 10, how it was important to keep the spirit and form of popular government with only a minimum of the substance. How do you construct a government? This was the task, he said, that the framers were facing. How do you construct a government that would win some popular support but would not tamper with the existing class structure? A government strong enough to service the growing needs of an entrepreneurial class while withstanding the democratic egalitarian demands of the popular class. And the way you do it is by excluding the popular class from most of the crucial points of power. The framers all agreed with Madison when he wrote in his Federalist number 10 that, quote, the most common and durable source of faction, and by faction he meant class whenever he used the word faction, the most common and durable source of faction has been the various and unequal distribution of property. Those who hold and those who are without property have ever formed distinct interests in society. Now, if you say that today, you're called a Marxist. Well, Madison was talking about reality, and we can't help it if certain forms of reality are Marxist. The first object of government, Madison went on, is the protection of different and unequal faculties for acquiring property. Elbridge Gerry, another one of the framers in Philadelphia, noted that democracy was the worst of all political evils. Both he and Madison warned of the danger of the leveling spirit. Roger Sherman of Connecticut, another delegate to Philadelphia, the people should have as little to do as may be about the government. Alexander Hamilton, of course, all communities divide themselves into the few and the many. The first are the rich and the well-born. The other are the mass of the people. And the people are turbulent and changing. They seldom judge or determine right. So these delegates were rather explicit that the further you could keep people from government, the better. Now, they spent many weeks debating their interests, and most of the historical accounts about the Founding Fathers is about these differences, the differences between merchants and slave owners and manufacturers, the debate between the Northerners and the Southerners. But this was a debate of haves versus haves, in which each group sought to safeguard its own interests. And it involved mostly questions of representation and structure. On these issues, there were no dirt farmers or poor artisans attending the convention to offer an opposing view. They couldn't take 4 months off to go to Philadelphia. And for the most part, the framers built a constitution that would have the power to support commerce and protect the interests of property in a variety of ways. Lay and collect taxes, establish a national currency, fix imports and duties, and the like, set up uniform laws on bankruptcy, pay the debts, and so forth. Some of the delegates, for instance, were land speculators, and they expressed a real concern about Western holdings and dealing with the Indian tribes. And so Congress was given the, quote, the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. That's right from our Constitution. In other words, to deal with the territories and the Indians. Some delegates were speculated very highly in inflated and nearly worthless securities that had been floated under the Articles of Confederation. Well, under Article 6, all debts that had been incurred under the Confederation were now valid against the new government, and this allowed speculators to make enormous profits because they bought these securities, for a pittance, and now they were being refunded and honored at face value. So they made quite a killing for themselves. In the interest of these merchants and creditors, the states were prohibited from issuing paper money or imposing duties on imports and exports or interfering with the payment of debts. But there was another form of property that was mentioned in the Constitution. a very important one, and it was afforded a special accommodation, slavery, the property of other human beings. They were never called slaves. They would say persons in bondage and bondage and such, and persons in servitude. The importation of slaves, they were never called slaves in the Constitution, but that's what they were. The importation of slaves was given constitutional protection for about 20 years, another 20 years. Slaves who escaped from one state to another had to be delivered up to the original owner upon claim. This was a provision that was unanimously adopted in the convention. The framers were also worried about rebellions by workers and such. And would the state militias prove reliable as the working class grew in numbers? And by the way, they anticipated a day when the mass of the people would be working, not on their own land, but working as employees. Well, Congress was given the task of, quote, organizing, arming, and disciplining the militia and calling it forth to suppress insurrections. Those are quotes right from the Constitution. And by the way, that was a provision that was to prove a godsend for the industrial barons a century later in the 1870s, 80s, and 90s, when the army was used repeatedly to break strikes by miners and railroad workers and factory workers. The method of representation was interesting. Nobody could vote for the president. The chief executive was to be selected by an electoral college that was voted by the people. But the framers anticipated that these meetings of the electoral college in each in the various states would consist of political leaders and men of substance. Again, who would be able to travel to the state capital and sit there and debate who should be president? They'd gather in their various states and they would choose a president of their own liking. So the electoral college was set up as a kind of filter against popular sentiment. The Senate could not be elected. The Senate was picked by the state legislatures, rather than directly elected by the people. Senators were not elected by the people until the 20th century. The Supreme Court, which could have final say over the constitutionality of laws, was elected by no one. Its justices were appointed to life tenure by the president and confirmed by the Senate. So you had a very elaborate structure up there that was far removed from the popular will. The only portion of government that was directly elected by the people was the House of Representatives, and even that took something of an argument to get through. It took a number of people. The delegates finally agreed to having the people elect the lower house. But when they talked about the people, by the way, when they talked about the people, they were referring to a select portion of the population. As I said, property qualifications disfranchised the poorest white males in various states. There were all sorts of other ways of disfranchising would-be voters. Literacy tests, inaccessibility of voting. You'd have to go 10, 15 miles on a horse and wagon to get to the county seat to vote. You were not likely to vote over those muddy roads and whatever else. Half of the adult population was denied suffrage because they were women. American Indians had no access to the ballot. About one-fourth of both men and women had no vote because they were held in bondage. And even the African Americans who had gained their legal freedom, the black people who had gained their freedom in both the North and the South, which was a small portion, but none was allowed to vote until the passage of the 14th Amendment. Well, the question comes up, well, were these framers of the Constitution motivated by financial interests of their own, simply, or by a national interest? This has been debated ever since Charles Beard published a very great book, which I recommend to you, An Economic Interpretation of the Constitution, which he published in 1913. The defenders of our, quote, founding fathers said they weren't guided by their class interests. They were concerned with higher things, things other than just lining their purses. They were motivated by a concern for nation building that went beyond their particular class interests. The argument so goes. Well, I think that the fallacy to presume that there's a dichotomy between the desire to build a strong nation and the desire to protect wealth is, as I say, that's a fallacy. And the framers, and the other fallacy is to presume that the framers could not have been motivated by both. In fact, like most people, they believed that what was good for them was ultimately good for the entire society. Their universal values and their class values went hand in hand. And to discover the existence of a higher sentiment, that they wanted a strong central government, a strong nation, doesn't eliminate it, the self-interested one. I mean, just as many of these same framers could say and sincerely feel that they were dedicated to the principle of liberty for all and at the same time own slaves, so they could serve both their nation and their estates. The point is not that they were devoid of a grander sentiment of nation building, but that there was nothing in their concept of nation that worked against their class interests. And there was a great deal in their concept of nation, including a strong central government, a government with checks and balances, and a government that was removed from popular will, a great deal in their concept of a national government that worked for their class interests. It was to filter out the popular will and to thwart or blunt the leveling impulses of the people. Those historians who argue that the founders were motivated primarily by high-minded objectives consistently overlook the fact that the founders themselves repeatedly stated their intentions to erect a government strong enough to protect the haves from the have-nots. I mean, they said that explicitly. They gave voice to the crassest class prejudices. I just quoted you a few examples. They talked about how the people were unreliable, the people couldn't judge, and all that sort of thing. Their concern was to diminish popular control and resist all tendencies toward class equalization or class justice, or what they called in that day leveling. Their opposition and their distrust of democracy, and by democracy they meant what Plato and Aristotle meant by democracy and what I mean by democracy, they meant a system not just of elections but a system that served the interests of the demos, of the mass of the people. Their opposition to democracy and their dedication to moneyed interests was openly and repeatedly avowed. In fact, their preoccupation with their class interests was so pronounced that one of the delegates, James Wilson of Pennsylvania, finally complained that he was hearing too much about how the sole or primary object of government was property and defending property and protecting property. The cultivation and improvement of the human mind, Wilson maintained, was the most notable object. And this was a very fine sentiment, and it evoked no opposition from his colleagues, and they continued to go about their business. As for democracy, let me point out that when Colonel Mason of Virginia got up toward the end of the convention, and he said, "This Constitution needs a Bill of Rights," that proposal was voted down unanimously, without debate, with just the delegation from Massachusetts abstaining. So the Constitution was a rather undemocratic instrument. Well, if it was so blatantly elitist, how did it manage to win ratification? How did it win the popular vote? Well, in fact, the Constitution was never submitted to a popular vote. It was never ratified by the people. It was ratified in state conventions, and those conventions were controlled by generally men of substance or whatever else. And having said all this, let me add, though, that the Constitution was not without some real democratic concessions for its time. For instance, there was no property qualifications for federal office. Salaries were going to be paid to officials. This eliminated then the practice of public office being open only to the rich who could afford it. The president and all office holders were elected for limited terms. No one could claim a life tenure on any office except the Supreme Court justices and the other federal judges. There was no religious test required for qualification. That was a progressive and democratic step forward. By the way, that was a feature that's very different from in a number of state constitutions. There were explicit bans against Catholics, Jews, and non-believers from holding office. There were bills of attainder were outlawed, that is, you can't find someone guilty of an offense without benefit of a trial. And then eventually, the Congress was forced to pass the first 10 amendments. In fact, the only way they could guarantee getting the Constitution ratified, a number of states said, "We'll ratify it only if you pledge to put in a Bill of Rights." And that Bill of Rights had a whole bunch of excellent democratic things like freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom to assemble, freedom to peaceably petition for redress of grievances, a separation of church and state. The Constitution also did something else. It guaranteed a republican form of government. Article 1, Section 9, no title of nobility shall be granted by the Constitution. In other words, it said this is an open system and all that, but you cannot go back to monarchy or aristocracy. Which was a real concession, because about 21 of the 55 delegates favored some form of monarchy. They couldn't come out and say it because of popular opposition, but about 21, almost half of the delegates would have, if they had their way, they would have had a king. So, These men feared and loathed democracy, and yet, on a number of occasions, they found it necessary to show some regard for popular sentiment, as with the direct election of the lower house, as with putting in a republican form of government, and so forth. They understood that if the Constitution was going to be accepted by the states, and if it was going to have any stability, it had to gain some measure of popular acceptance. So they felt compelled to leave something for the people. So they were powerful. They dominated the events of 1787 to 1789, but they were far from omnipotent. The class system they sought to preserve was itself the cause of marked restlessness among the people, and this is the contradiction they're constantly dealing with. There still continue to be land seizures by the poor, food riots, and other violent disturbances throughout the 18th century. This popular ferment, by the way, spurred the framers in their effort to erect a strong central government, but it also set a limit on what they could do. So they, and what I'm saying is, they didn't give us a Bill of Rights. They didn't give us these democratic things. These were won by the agitation of democratic forces in the society. These were concessions, including the Bill of Rights, which they reluctantly, just reluctantly gave up. They had to make concessions, just the way management today reluctantly gives certain concessions or a contract to its workers because, that's what they've got to do because the workers are well organized enough and this is the only way to get them back to work. So it was under the threat of democratic rebellion that they made these democratic concessions. They kept what they could, and they grudgingly relinquished what they felt they had to. And what I'm saying, the myth of the Founding Fathers, is that they were driven not by a love of democracy, but by a fear of it. Not by a love of the people, but by a prudent desire to avoid popular uprisings. The Constitution, then, was a product not only of class privilege, but of class struggle, a struggle that continues to this day.
That was Michael Parenti speaking on the Founding Fathers. The next talk is on the real causes of World War II.
The usual explanations for World War II are the following. Hitler was a maniac and bent on world conquest, and nothing could stop him. Second, the West tried to avoid war by appeasing him. Third, the Soviet Union entered into an unholy alliance with Hitler in the Hitler-Stalin Pact and collaborated and made it possible for him to have his successes. I want to show that all three of these statements are misleading and in some respects downright false in their implications. Let's begin with the first one. Hitler could have been stopped. He was not unstoppable, and there were powerful forces in the German army itself that were ready to stop him. In 1935, Hitler unilaterally scrapped the Versailles Peace Treaty that limited Germany to 7 divisions. He began a major mobilization of 21 divisions. He then told his generals he was going to move toward 36 divisions. His generals were stunned. 7 divisions was woefully inadequate, but this was a mobilization for another total war in Europe. In 1937, Hitler told his general staff that indeed he planned war against France, Poland, and Russia, and it would come sometimes within the next 6 years. In fact, it came within 2 years. Again, Hitler's generals were absolutely flabbergasted about this and really concerned. Another war, a total war against all of Europe, was one that would bring the inevitable defeat and destruction of Germany. Well, what happened was a concerted conspiracy was begun by the German General Staff to kill Hitler and remove the Nazis from power. The Wehrmacht, the German army, would surround and move against the Nazi SS divisions. Key commanders would move their divisions in place and take over the Nazi elite forces. A special commando unit would be set up to storm Hitler's headquarters and kill him. The generals did not see how Germany could fight 2 million French, the entire Polish army, and the small but powerful Czechoslovakian army, not to mention the British, who would be joining in inevitably. To save Germany, they decided to move against Hitler. But they got no cooperation from the West. In 1936, Hitler violated the Versailles Peace Treaty by remilitarizing the Rhineland. England and France did nothing to stop him. Hitler said England and France would do nothing to stop. His generals said it was too risky to move into the Rhineland. England and France proved Hitler right. In 1938, the generals were about to strike. Much of the German general staff was involved. They hated Adolf Hitler. They hated the way the Nazis had treated the German military staff. I counted about 60 or so senior officers who were eventually executed by the Nazis, or arrested, or died one way or the other, or when these plans were eventually exposed. So they were ready to move again, but Hitler annexed Austria, and the Western leaders did nothing, and the plans to do in Hitler had to be postponed. They were temporarily, politically impossible because Hitler was triumphing so much. The Western Allies gave him Austria on a platter. It was hard to convince people that Hitler was destroying Germany when in fact he seemed to be empowering Germany. Later that same year, in September 1938, war loomed inevitably. It seemed inevitable again. A war that the German generals believed they could not win. Hitler was laying claim to the entire Western industrial base of Czechoslovakia, known as the Sudetenland. It was time to act. To destroy Hitler, or Germany would be destroyed, was the thinking among the German general staff. And by the way, not just with the German military, but with other elements in the Abwehr, which was the German secret intelligence, not the Nazi Gestapo, not the Nazi party, but the government group, and a number of other groups, there were people who felt that Hitler had to be stopped. They were themselves all pretty much conservatives, by the way. Let me quote from Herbert Moley Mason's book, To Kill the Devil, which is an account of the attempts against Hitler. He tells about one of the generals, Witzleben, who tells Heinz to recruit a company of commandos with which to storm the chancellery to take Hitler into custody. Witzleben suggests that Heinz's commandos should comprise students and workers as well as Wehrmacht officers, so that the world would realize that this was not a South American-style army coup, but a revolt against tyranny by a cross-section of the German people. Heinz got busy and soon had 60 men together. He and Oster, who was another conspirator, hatched a plan. They agreed that the push could only be guaranteed a success if the Führer were to be killed on the spot. In their eyes, Hitler dead was unquestionably better than Hitler alive and in prison. At H hour, Heinz would lead his commandos into the chancellery, blow in the doors, and rush upstairs and arrest the Führer. Heinz said he would see to it that an incident was provoked, providing an excuse to shoot Hitler down, and then and there. Shot while trying to escape was the standard Gestapo and SS explanation for execution of political prisoners. And Heinz said the same phrase could be applied in the case of the Führer. Meanwhile, the other German generals would order the regular troops into action. By mid-September, the conspirators believed they had the pistol cocked and ready, aimed at the head of state. All that was needed was the order to pull the trigger. The trigger pulling would be initiated by Hitler himself when he announced publicly his intention to seize Czechoslovakia by force, and the hammer would fly forward when the British and French handed down their decision to go to war over the principle of safeguarding the integrity of small nations. Beck believed this is what they would do. Beck was the German general who was in charge of the conspiracy. The Czechoslovakian people believed that the British and French would do the very same thing. At that same time, Hitler ordered a panzer division with supporting infantry to parade through Berlin. The crowd stood sullenly and watched them pass. This is Mason's description, by the way. It's a very interesting point. He notes that the Führer had hoped for enthusiasm. Watching the apathetic reaction from a chancellery window, he was disgusted. He turned away and he said to an adjutant, "I can't wage a war yet with people like this." In other words, the German people were not all that gung-ho about war. They were ready to take Hitler in if it meant an end to the inflation, and if it meant a relative betterment in economic conditions. In fact, the German workers were having a very tough time. One-third cut in their wages, increases in their taxes. They were having a very hard time, but it was still better than total unemployment, and it was still better than starvation that some of them faced under the Weimar. But there was no enthusiasm for any idea of war again. They had just had a bitter and terrible war just 17 years before, and they remember the hardships and the loss and whatever else. So Hitler did not have mass support for war, much outside his party. Well, The German generals were ready to move against Hitler if he struck against Czechoslovakia and led to an impossible war. But once again, British Prime Minister Chamberlain came to Hitler's rescue. The Czechs were ready to fight. The Soviet Union was ready to fight and said it would join Czechoslovakia in the war against Hitler. The Soviet Union made repeated overtures to Great Britain and France and Poland and Czechoslovakia for a joint military pact, security pact against Hitler, that if he attacked any one of them, he would be attacked by all of them. But the British and French refused to join such a pact. Instead, the British and French hurried to Munich and gave Hitler the Sudetenland. The German general plan was collapsed. There was going to be no threat of war. There was going to be no danger to Germany. There was going to be no reason to move against Hitler. The conspirators pulled back. When the German military moved into western Czechoslovakia, and they took all the western half of Czechoslovakia, they were impressed by the great defenses. Czechoslovakia could not stand alone against Germany, and so it surrendered. Czechoslovakia was not even allowed to attend Munich. It was at the Munich conference that Chamberlain gave Hitler Czechoslovakia, and that was the beginning of the end of the peace. 5 months later, Hitler moved in and took all of Czechoslovakia. Let's take the second explanation, that Great Britain and France appeased Hitler, and this is what led to the war. They proved weak and had no backbone. Well, they were war-weary, and they were unwilling to fight. They were willing to take peace at any price. That's really not quite true. They had been war-weary after World War I, and yet they proved themselves very willing to fight. Right after World War I, British and French sent, and 12 other nations sent expeditionary forces to invade and fight in the Soviet Union, in Soviet Russia, as it was still called then, to overthrow the Russian Revolution. So they were quite ready to fight if it was to fight communists. They were not ready to fight the fascists. They were reluctant to confront Germany even when it was weak and could have been stopped in 1935 when it had only about 7 or 10 divisions. They had wind that the German generals were wavering. They had wind that there was a very serious conspiracy afoot. The British intelligence heard from the Abwehr, the German secret service, secret intelligence. The Abwehr tried to feed London secret information on the Nazi buildup. Chamberlain was not interested. Chamberlain failed to respond to all overtures from the anti-Nazi Germans, even high-placed ones who commanded divisions of troops, even conservative ones. In other words, I believe Chamberlain was not an appeaser. He was an active collaborator of Adolf Hitler's. They actively encouraged Hitler's policy. On Czechoslovakia, Chamberlain himself threatened Czechoslovakia if the Czechs failed to accept Munich. He threatened to freeze their assets. He would deny them all materials if they decided to stand up alone against Germany. And he handed over all Czech assets in England to Adolf Hitler when Hitler took over all of Czechoslovakia. He engaged in the active participation and dismemberment of Czechoslovakia and handed it over to the Nazis on a platter. Chamberlain saw Hitler and Nazism as a bulwark against communism in Germany. And he saw Nazi Germany as a bulwark against communism in Europe. With a few exceptions like Winston Churchill, Western leaders were more concerned with the Bolshevik specter than with the fascist reality. They were uneasy about Hitler's emergent power, but they didn't look upon fascism with the same loathing and fear that they did communism. Unlike the communists, the fascists were not a threat to private enterprise. If anything, the fascists had crushed socialist organizations in Germany and Italy and had made these countries safer for private capital. Now, to be sure, Chamberlain and his associates were eager to avoid war. They didn't want war. But much of that eagerness arose not from some kind of pacifism, some commitment to peace, or peace at any price, but from a willingness to strike the kind of bargain with a Nazi leader that they would never dream of entering into with the Soviets. The British historian Jeffrey Barakoff argued, quote, "Hitler's successes in foreign policy would do less to German rearmament, the deficiencies and limitations of which were known to competent military circles, than to the tacit alliance of powerful reactionary elements in England and France, which, although loath to see a reassertion of German equality, was still more unwilling to check it by military alliance with Soviet Russia, or to run the risk of social revolution in Germany as a result of Hitler's fall." In other words, I'm not saying that Chamberlain necessarily loved Hitler, although there were plenty of leaders in the West who did. There was all sorts of people in America. Henry Ford was an open Nazi admirer, and a number of other American plutocrats, and a number of people in England also. But Chamberlain's feeling was, if I had to choose between Nazism and Hitler, or the risk, even the risk of Soviet influence in Germany, then we will take Nazism. They could much better live with the reality, the horrible reality of fascism, than with the future imagined risk of socialism. Western leaders had never really quite reconciled themselves to the existence of a socialist Russia. And they, at the same time, they did fear Germany's growing strength. So their strategy was to turn Hitler's aggression against the USSR. So it wasn't appeasement. Chamberlain went to Munich because he had a plan. And that plan was to give Hitler what he wanted and then send Hitler east to attack Bolshevik Russia. After all, Chamberlain and his party had just attacked Bolshevik Russia. Let's see, we're talking 1939. They had just been there just 18 years before, 1921, invading Russia and trying to stop the revolution. By the way, this was not an altogether unrealistic plan. Given the rabid anti-communism and anti-Sovietism professed by the Nazi leaders, they were quite ready, and they talked about moving east, you know. The commander-in-chief of the French armed forces, General Gamelin, wrote in his memoirs that one of the aims of the Anglo-French alliance was to bring about a clash between German and Soviet interests. Harry Truman had made that famous statement. I mean, we ought to let Hitler and Stalin fight each other until they totally exhaust each other and bleed each other white. Now, in Asia, the United States and Great Britain have had something of the same plan. They did very little to deter Japanese aggressions in Manchuria and China. And here, too, the anticipation was that the Japanese might move against the Soviet Union. And so they were willing to give them a free hand, just as they were willing to give Hitler a free hand in Central Europe, in Austria and Czechoslovakia. And by the way, this is exactly what happened. In 1938, the Japanese militarists entered an alliance with Germany and Italy. It was called the Anti-Comintern Pact. The Comintern was the Communist International, made up of International Association of Communist Parties, which were heavily under the influence and hegemony of the Soviet Communist Party. The Anti-Comintern Pact, an alliance of three fascist nations, Japan, Germany, and Italy, and they vowed a joint struggle against world communism. The Japanese then attacked the Soviet Union that same year near the Outer Mongolia area, leading to a full-scale war that ended with Japan's suffering 18,000 casualties and military defeat. During all this time, by the way, American corporations continued to expand their investments in German heavy industry, including arms productions. I'm talking about corporations like Ford Motor Company and General Motors. Now let's move to the third proposition, that the Hitler-Stalin Pact, or the Nazi-Soviet Pact, the most talked about treaty in history. By the way, it's still regularly referred to in the U.S. media at every opportunity as a meeting of the devils about how Hitler and Stalin met and made this alliance. Munich, by the way, is never described as the Hitler-Chamberlain Pact or the Nazi-British Pact, which it was. It's always antiseptically called Munich. Well, as I said, the Soviet Union had made repeated overtures to conclude collective security pacts with the United States and Great Britain in order to contain both German and Japanese aggression. These overtures were repeatedly ignored or rebuffed, including the Soviet attempts to render armed assistance to Czechoslovakia. In time, Soviet leaders lost what little confidence they had had in the sincerity and ultimate purposes of the Western democracies. It was evident that had Hitler at this time struck directly at Russia, he would have encountered very little, if any, opposition from France or Britain. As the historian Foster A. Dulles notes, the American government and Great Britain and France had an attitude which was to do nothing to free the Soviet Union from its anxieties regarding Hitler's crusade against communism.
If it were impossible to crush Nazi aggression by a united front, Stalin felt the next best thing for Russia was to attempt to divert any immediate German attack from the Soviet Union. In the summer of 1939, the Soviets made frantic efforts to enter into negotiations with Western leaders, French and British leaders. French and British sent a delegation by boat to Moscow, which took a week. When they arrived, they had no protocol papers. And the question came up is, where are your papers? Who do you represent? Can you negotiate with state authority? It became clear during that summer that a stall was underway. So what in fact happened is that Stalin began to make overtures with the Nazis. Isolated by the West, frustrated in its last-minute attempts to form an anti-Nazi alliance with Great Britain and France, and I would point out, the Soviet Union was the only country in 1936, 7, and 8 that was the only major country that was trying to form an anti-Nazi alliance. And believing that it was being set up as a target for Hitler's aggression, and they believed correctly, the Soviets decided to sign an 11th-hour non-aggression treaty with Hitler in the summer of 1939. To this day, the conservatives talk about this diabolic affinity between the Nazis and the communists for signing this pact. Conservative news columnist George Will would write, "The 1939 Nazi-Soviet pact truly was a joining of kindred spirits." On another occasion, George Will described the Soviet Union as a regime that was, quote, once allied with Hitler. In fact, the Soviet Union was never allied with Nazi Germany. The pact was a treaty, but it wasn't an alliance. It no more indicated an alliance with Nazism than would a non-aggression treaty between the United States and the Soviets indicate a U.S. alliance with communism. The pact was neither an alliance nor an agreement for the partition of Poland. Now, Munich had been a true alliance for partition. The British and the French dictated partition to the Czechs. They said, you obey, this is what's going to happen, and you better toe the line, and the Germans are taking you over. The Soviet government undertook no such action against the Poles. They merely promised to remain neutral, which is what the Poles had always asked them to do anyway. The Poles did not want to enter an alliance with the Soviets against the Germans. More than this, the agreement was, in the last resort, anti-German because it limited the German advance eastward in case of war. And this is what Winston Churchill emphasized. With the pact, the Soviets hoped to ward off what they most dreaded, a united capitalist attack on Soviet Russia. And really, it was difficult to see what other course Soviet Russia could have followed. Ideally, they wanted the grand alliance with the West against the Nazis. But barring that, they turned the tables and made a pact with Hitler. When Hitler attacked Poland, the Soviets moved into Latvia, Lithuania, and Estonia, the Baltic territories that had been taken from them by Germany, Britain, and Poland in 1919. They overthrew the right-wing dictatorships that were in those countries. By the way, today we ought to remember when we hear about Lithuania going back to its democracy, that Lithuania wasn't a democracy. There were right-wing dictatorships that the Western counter-revolutionaries had installed in the Baltic states. The three states were incorporated as three republics into the USSR. The Soviets also took back Western Belarus, the Western Ukraine, and other areas seized from them and incorporated into the Polish right-wing dictatorship in 1921 under the Treaty of Riga. This has been portrayed as proof that they colluded with the Nazis to gobble up Poland. But the Soviets reoccupied only the area that had been taken from them 20 years before. History offers few, if any, examples of a nation refusing the opportunity to regain territory that had been seized from it. In any case, by reclaiming their old boundaries, the Soviets did draw a line on the Nazi advance. Even after Hitler attacked Poland and Great Britain and France declared war on Germany, the Western collaboration did not end. And this is a part of the history that's not known, never mentioned by George Will, never mentioned by commentators today, and not mentioned by many historians either. When Hitler struck east into Poland, nothing happened on the Western front. Now, don't forget, Great Britain and France had just declared war. There were still feelers from London and Paris about making a separate peace with Hitler so that he could concentrate on Soviet Russia. From September 1939, when World War II began, to May of 1940, about 8 months, there was no fighting between Germany and the Western Allies, even though they were at war with each other. The French began to call it la guerre drôle, the funny war, or the droll war, or the lazy war, whatever you want to call it. Others called it the Zitzkrieg, as opposed, instead of the Blitzkrieg, it was a Sitzkrieg, a sit-down war. In England and France, it was called the phony war. There was very little fighting. Now, Hitler had every intention of taking on the USSR. That was going to be his final big fight. He wanted the breadbasket of the Ukraine. He wanted the oil fields of Baku. He wanted to destroy the communists. But he had to widen his base before attacking the Soviet Union. And so he took Denmark and Norway. He invaded them in April of 1940. That gave him more resources, more food, more farmlands, more factories, more conscript labor. Even then, high-placed conspirators in the German general staff made overtures to Great Britain for coordination of efforts. General Oster, Colonel Sass, General Beck, and even Field Marshal Rommel later on, they warned the British of Hitler's forthcoming, quote, violent, brutal offensive in the West. The British didn't take it serious. The British understood that there was an understanding with the Germans, and they were giving them all this European real estate, and they were finally going to move east and knock off the communist menace. If the British would only guarantee the plotters, the Germans said, a fair peace, they would go at Hitler and overthrow his Nazi regime. The new government would relinquish Czechoslovakia and Poland and everything else except Austria. That was their first offer. London did not even take the offer seriously. In May of 1940, Hitler struck west. He wiped out France and much of the British army at Dunkirk. Then he attacked the Soviet Union in 1941. Stalin had expected it sooner or later. In 1939, Stalin had said, "We have 10 years. In 10 years, we have to do what Britain did in 100 years. And there came the forced industrialization, as Soviet Russia built a whole new industrial base east of the Urals, an industrial base which eventually outproduced Hitler in tanks, planes, and artillery. 80% of the German casualties were on the Eastern Front. The scale and ferocity of the fighting was unparalleled in the West, or in any modern warfare ever. There was nothing in the Western Front that could compare to the Battle of Stalingrad, involving millions of troops. The Battle of Leningrad, where 2.5 million Soviets died. The Battle of Kursk, involving tens of thousands of tanks. The Battle of Warsaw, which took 2 months. The Battle of Berlin, where 3 million Soviet troops were arrayed against 1.5 million German troops, with almost 1 million casualties by both sides. Most discussions in the West about World War II focus on the Western War, which is about one-fifth of the actual war, and ignore the scale and horror and heroism of the Eastern Front. Most discussions in the West about the eve of World War II give us the usual blather about the Hitler-Stalin Pact and say little about the active collaboration of the right-wing Tory government, about the Hitler-Chamberlain Pact. Just as little today is said about the active collaboration of a right-wing U.S. government with fascists throughout the Third World and with Nazis in the Republican Party and in Bush's own campaign. The fascists are okay because they defend private property and corporate investments. It's the communists that are the menace, according to those who own the world. Those of us who want democracy might want to think about this a little more seriously.
You heard author and political analyst Michael Parenti speaking on the real causes of World War II. Our final talk today is on Mumia Abu-Jamal, an African-American journalist who is falsely accused but has spent the last 12 years on death row. On June 25, 1995, Michael Parenti spoke at a rally for Mumia in Berkeley, California.
What's happening to Mumia is no isolated incident. All over this country for decades on end, African Americans, Latinos, and others, including some white radical leaders like Mark Curtis, who's still in jail on trumped-up charges, those who have exercised leadership in their communities have been railroaded into jail, or murdered by the police, or subjected to legal lynchings. The oppression operates in three basic areas. First, there's the on-the-street aggressions provoked and perpetrated by the racist cops who use their badges and guns as a cover, an opportunity to vent their racist animosities and personal distortions. All this, brothers and sisters, is a matter of public record. Case after case of police brutality, case after case of million-dollar settlements.
Second is the mass trafficking in drugs, in which the police play an active role as distributors along with federal agencies like the CIA that are linked to overseas traffickers. All this, sisters and brothers, all this is a matter of public record. Three congressional committees have presented findings on this fact. And so you have African-American leaders like Martin Sostre, Frank Shufford, Hurricane Carter, members of Black Men Against Crack. All of them were railroaded into jail on trumped-up charges because they moved against the drug traffickers. On the third level is the coordinated, systematic efforts of federal, state, and local agencies to destroy any protest organizations in poor communities because the powers that be prefer demoralized, divided, disorganized, and drug-ridden populations to ones that are politicized. They prefer them to the ones that demand a better deal. They prefer them to the ones that are mobilized for collective action and radical change. And those drugs were not grown in Detroit and Harlem. Those drugs were brought into the communities. And so the Young Lords and the Blackstone Rangers and the Black Panthers and the Crips and the Bloods, they all had less trouble from the police when they were involved in petty crimes and gang wars than when they united and they turned their efforts towards social change. The Panthers were a revolutionary group. Their headquarters in over a dozen cities was systematically attacked by local police under the guidance of federal agents. Their typewriters were smashed, their funds were taken, their members were killed. 43 of their members were killed. Dozens more were incarcerated. Some of them are still in jail. Brothers and sisters, this is all a matter of public record. Now, these three levels work symbiotically with each other. The racist cop gets an implicit green light from up high, and the officials are served in their larger agenda by the cops and the drug traffickers. There's an orchestration here. There was in Mumia's case. There's no racist cop in the world who ever put anybody on death row. He needs DAs and he needs judges and he needs governors and he even needs presidents to do it. There's a conscious intent here. There's a conscious intent. Look who is not on death row. Not those who prey upon the inner city communities, not the drug traffickers, the pimps, the mobsters, the landlords, the homicidal cops, not those who take lives by violating occupational safety laws and marketing lethal products. They're not on death row. They're not even in jail. Mumia is just the kind of person who is killed by CIA death squads in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. Just the kind they hate and fear. Articulate, dedicated, incorruptible, courageous, critical of the anti-democratic and greed-ridden forces that prey upon us. There's a racist term that's rather interesting. Not that I usually think of racist terms as interesting, but it's interesting because it originally was used against whites by other whites, specifically against poor whites by more affluent whites, and the term was white trash. It also contains a class bigotry within it. Well, sisters and brothers, I've decided that there's white trash in this country, but don't look among the rural poor or Appalachia to find them. The real white trash is in the corporate boardrooms, the governor's mansion, the courthouses, the national media, the White House. If you work for or ally yourselves with the high place vipers and hypocrites and thieves and polluters and repressors and assassins, you are trash. I am sick of these so-called leaders who are leading us to the slaughter. I'm sick of their blow-dry hairdos, their sleek, beefy, money-fed smiles, their pinstripe suits, and their tight-ass struts down the corridors of power. I'm sick of the sight of them, and I hate them with all the passion of my humanity, and don't anybody tell me to feel otherwise. Mumia Abu-Jamal, that beautiful African-American man, that utterly beautiful, beautiful man, beautiful inside as well as outside, who should be here among us so that we might bathe in the warmth of his light and his intelligence and honesty, he represents the very best among us who are targeted by this thoroughly corrupt and evil system. Your presence here tonight is testimony to the fact that you've liberated yourself from their lies and deceptions, that you're a force for something better, that you're resisting their overweening, arrogant power. If we're to vent our riotous anger, let it be before they try to murder this beautiful brother, not after. Rise up, remember what Mumia's life is teaching us, that not only must we love social justice more than personal self-interest, but that we best protect our self-interest by struggling for social justice. And we are more in touch with our own individual humanity when we stand close to all of humanity. And when we save the life of this beloved brother, we reclaim something of our own lives. Thank you.
That was author and political analyst Michael Parenti speaking at a Berkeley, California rally for falsely accused death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal. The first two talks today were from the Real History series, The Founding Fathers, followed by The Real Causes of World War II. You can obtain a copy of these talks and others by Michael Parenti from People's Video Audio in Seattle. For a free list of tapes, call People's Video Audio at area code 206-789-5371. That's area code 206-789-5371. This is Sally Soriano for People's Video Audio. Thanks for listening.